Hello and welcome everyone to Barings 2026 Global Fixed Income Outlook. My name is Greg Campion. I'm a managing director here at Barings and host of the firm's podcast, Streaming Income. I am very pleased to be co-hosting this discussion today with my colleague, Trevor Slavin. Trevor is our head of global asset allocation and multi-asset portfolio solutions. Trevor, how are you feeling? You ready to do this thing?
I feel great. Yeah.
All right. Looking forward to it. All right, let's get into it. One quick thing before we start. We did make some promises on social media. Claims were made, possibly some guarantees that this discussion would not be, quote unquote, boring. You think we can pull that off?
I tell you, I'd be concerned if it was just you and me up here talking for 45 minutes. But fortunately, we have four great, incredible guests today, senior portfolio managers, business leaders. So I know they'll be compelling. I'd be a bit more concerned if it was just us.
I think so too. We got a great lineup of guests and we will bring them on very shortly. Before we do that, I wanted to turn it over to you, Trevor, to see if you could help set the stage for us. Maybe just give us 2 minutes background on kind of what you're seeing out there, some of the big trends that you're following that may set the stage for global fixed income markets in 2026.
Sure. So obviously our theme here is signals in the noise. And I think there are a number of factors contributing to that noise today. I think I'm going to call out three that we'd love to hear where our panelists kind of see, the opportunity set and the risk going into 2026. One, we show here in this first chart is there's an incredible set of economic divergences today. Most notably, we're seeing this corporate investment boom around AI and the infrastructure related to that versus a very, very soft labor market, kind of the softest we've seen in a number of years. You also have, looking at the consumer, the highest income or wealthiest cohorts are doing well, supported by a buoyant stock market. The lowest income consumers are struggling a bit. And so as a result, you're seeing a lot of divergences across industries and sectors. So very excited to sort of hear about how our teams are thinking about the opportunity set for security selection and driving alpha through picking winners and avoiding losers around this divergence going into next year. Mm-hmm. I think the second thing is related to the Fed. We recently got another rate cut, and yet it came with dissent in both directions, which we haven't seen in our lifetimes, really, as well as some pushback from Chair Powell. And so to me, it kind of highlights the realities underpinning these dissents. On the one hand, you have stock market at or near all-time highs. You have core inflation that's still sticky above a target closer to 3% than 2%. Yet on the other side, and this is what we're showing in this chart here in the gray area, is for those that are calling for Fed easing, you can look to the job market. You can look to inflation, excluding shelter, to get a growth picture that's much, much lower. And so I guess where I'm going with that is you could see, and certainly are hearing in the market, calls for a rate path that could be another 100 basis points lower than what's priced. Mm-hmm. You could see in our hearing arguments for 100 basis points higher. And so want to hear about how people are thinking, not just managing interest rate risk within their portfolios into 2026, but how these different sort of possible rate paths are influencing how they're thinking about their asset class more broadly. Mm-hmm. And then I would say the last thing, just kind of related to that, is on valuations. Here we're picking at, in the investment grade market, we could show probably any asset class and see a very similar picture. And that is spreads are pretty darn tight. And so again, trying to sort of tie into avoiding losers versus picking winners in this market. However, on the other side, all in yields are still really attractive. You look at the last 10, 15, even 25 years, we're still kind of at the upper end of that range of all in yields. That's where we see a great opportunity, or I'm excited to see how these PMs are thinking about the opportunity set in their asset class on the valuation front.
Yeah, love it. Great overview. Those are obviously super relevant trends right now and things that everybody's talking about. So let's talk about them. Let's turn to our guests. I wanna bring our first guest on here. All right, so let me welcome in Brian Pacheco joining from our London office today. Brian's a portfolio manager in our high yield group. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Trevor. Trevor, I think we're ready to suit you up and put you on the road to sell high yield. That was a good intro.
Let's do it.
Nice. Okay, well, speaking of high yield, Brian, that's what we want to dive into here. So let's talk about this. If you look at high yield, let's say over the last couple of years, the asset class has performed really well, right? So we've seen strong performance. We're at a point now, I guess, where spreads are getting close to historical tights. So a skeptic might say, okay, I've got spreads at historic tights. I've got some uncertainties creeping into markets. Some of the things that Trevor just mentioned in terms of some of the economic divergences, as such, some concerns about the consumer, all that. So let's start high level. Just take us through kind of the case for staying invested in high yield into 2026.
Sure. Well, you are correct that historically speaking, spreads are tight. But as longtime listeners of Streaming Income will know, the high yield market is not nearly as junky as it has been historically. So to unpack that a little bit, coming out of the global financial crisis, about 20% of the market was triple C rated or below, and about 40% was double B. That sort of flipped on its head, where you have 60% double Bs and only 10% of triple Cs in the current market. So you have a higher quality market. So by definition, your credit risk is lower. So that warrants lower spreads. At the same time, I don't think it's fair or complete to talk about risk or spreads unless you also mention volatility. I think something that's interesting over the last couple years, your return per unit of volatility has been in the 90th percentile. So what that means sort of simplistically is you look at spread duration as a measure of price sensitivity to changes in spreads, and it's around 3 years in high yield, which is historically a very low number. So what that means is if spreads widen, you're getting less of a price change or a price decline from that widening of spreads than you had historically. For example, in 2022, your spread duration was around 4.5 years. So that 1.5 years is pretty significant. And I think it speaks to the overall durability of the market. At the same time, you're getting fairly high coupons. Yes, a lot of it is the risk-free rate, but your all-in coupon is kind of around average that it's been for the post-GFC period. So you kind of add those three things up. You have a high-quality market, you have very low spread duration, and you have high income. And to me, that just speaks to sort of a very reasonable return outlook.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that sounds like a fairly, you know, positive outlook. Let me ask you, just to kind of play the skeptical role here, but what would cause you, I guess, to be less constructive at this point?
Yeah, so I spoke about resiliency, and I think in his intro, Trevor spoke about this a little bit, but it may sound odd coming from a credit guy, but, you know, I think the stock market is in control of the economy instead of the other way around. So that may have not been the case a couple decades ago, but to elaborate on that point a little bit, 90% of stocks are owned by around 10% of wealth. If you talk about the top 10% of income, that accounts for 50% of overall consumer spending. So unless that cohort, and yes, we're talking about wealth on the one hand and we're talking about income on the other, but there's a lot of overlap in that cohort. Unless that cohort is feeling some pain, it's going to be very hard for the economy to slow to a degree that would hurt high yield markets. So I think it needs to start with stocks. Housing would be sort of another source of that wealth effect or that wealth destruction that could cause a pullback in spending. But I think you need to watch stocks very closely.
And maybe just to unpack that a little bit more, BP. You know, this idea that at the index level, that doesn't always tell the full story. You mentioned all the pretty supportive features of the high yield, you know, market in aggregate today. We have seen a couple pockets of stress recently. A couple names have been making headlines as sort of distress situations. Are you seeing that as, you know, risks attached to the bottom part of this K-shaped economy that we've been talking about? Or are they more one-off, idiosyncratic episodes? And how are you thinking about that going into 2026?
Yeah, so one thing to, I think, point out up front is that idiosyncratic volatility is a feature, not a bug, of active investing in high-yield markets. I think the names you're referring to are Tricolor, which is a subprime lender, more of an ABS issue, so I won't really speak to that. But the other one was First Brands, which we're very familiar with. That is a credit we reviewed. It's a pretty large credit, depending on what index you're talking about, around 30 basis points in the index. But that is part of what we do every day. We're fortunate to have passed on First Brands. That one had a few red flags. I think it caught the media's attention because it was such a quick unwind. But when we reviewed it, we certainly noticed that the working capital ratios didn't really make sense relative to their competitors. The ownership structure was sort of opaque at best. They had done a lot of acquisitions and were a pretty sizable company, but still not using a Big Four accounting firm. So we didn't necessarily identify fraud. And you know, I certainly don't want to throw shade at people that may have invested in First Brands, because we certainly have made our fair share of mistakes. But I think to worry that this is some sort of a trend is sort of is disingenuous. They're getting headlines, but it's not. It's sort of everyday volatility that we have a big analyst team to deal with. I think you mentioned to address whether this is the lower part of the K-shaped economy. Not in these particular instances. I think these are one-offs. But certainly when we see weakness in our portfolios, and there has been some decompression, particularly in that triple C cohort, which, as I mentioned, is smaller than it's been. But where we see pockets of weakness, it is in that sort of lower end consumer.
Sure. And maybe if we just go to the top part of the K, the other kind of end of the spectrum in terms of these economic divergences. Obviously seeing this boom in infrastructure spend around, you know, AI data centers, and there's a massive demand for energy related to that, demand for infrastructure. How are those trends, and again, this sort of broader K-shaped dynamic that we're living in, and I'll add on your point around, you know, this idea that the stock market is sort of feeding into the real economy. How is that influencing your sector exposures as you go into 2026?
Well, a lot to sort of talk about there. I think to touch on the massive amount of AI spending, I think sort of briefly that ties into risk to the equity market, where either the adoption is too slow, the demand doesn't show up, and all of a sudden there's sort of a re-rating in the Mag 6 and a lot of these, you know, these companies that are spending so much on AI. On the flip side, to the extent it's adopted too quickly, you could have some unemployment increases in the 10% income earning, call it white collar labor force, which could have negative effects. As that whole AI trade relates to our portfolio, I think it's certainly more relevant to loans than it is to high yield bonds. But let's just say we're very sort of cognizant that it's a risk, and we know where we have edge and we don't have edge, and sort of AI is going to be an area where we're not really going to have edge. It's going to be very hard to predict who the winners and losers are. So we use common sense risk management. One example would be not owning a lot of software loans at par. We keep a very diversified book in that category. So we're seeing signs of it. The market is certainly shooting first and asking questions later. If you have a call center company, for example, they've been under significant pressure. Hasn't always shown up in the results, but the market is sorting these sorts of things out.
Any other big kind of structural trends out there, Brian? I guess the rollout of kind of GLP-1s and the effect of the healthcare space jump out, but any other big things out there that you're watching that are like big structural trends like this that are having kind of ripple effects throughout the high yield market?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, AI is the apex mega trend, if you will, but GLP-1s were certainly, it was more of a 23-24 story in our markets, but you had kind of a miniature version of what we're seeing in AI, where there was a sell-off of all things GLP-1 or GLP-1 adjacent, and it turned out to be a pretty good buying opportunity for us. It turns out people still like eating junk food. And if you're older and play a lot of tennis, you're still going to need knee replacement surgery. So there were certainly some really good companies that were thrown out with the companies that were legitimately at risk from GLP-1s. That is kind of, those are mini themes that we seek to generate alpha exploiting. But the AI theme is by far the largest, and you know the one we're sort of most focused on.
Yeah, got it. Okay, cool. Well, we will keep an eye on that. Would love to keep this conversation going, but we have a stellar lineup of guests coming behind you. So I want to kind of bring this to a conclusion, Brian. One bold prediction, hoping that you can share with us. I know you've done this in past years. This is your opportunity to take a victory lap on prior years if you want to. But one bold prediction for 26.
Last year I said no rate cuts, so there's no victory, just humility, here, because that one's already been proven wrong. Okay. So my bold prediction for 2026, I'm going to say that because of some of the themes we discussed earlier, so really return per unit of volatility, I think high yield spreads, and I'm going to use HNDC, which is a developed market benchmark, I think high yield spreads can go through the tights last seen in 2007. So that would be about 250 over for HNDC. Mm. The rationale is I think that low volatility and durability is going to attract new historically conservative dollars to the asset class and drive spreads. The path of least resistance is lower.
Okay, that's
cool. I'm gonna go create an alert on my desktop so that I can run that up the flag while I'll be watching that.
I just hope I make it to 2026.
Didn't say it was gonna finish 2026. Yeah. There, one tick above. Okay, yeah. Brian, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate the time, and we'll talk soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
I appreciate the boldness of Brian's prediction there. Any quick reaction from you on anything he said?
Yeah. As Brian mentioned, I think there's still opportunity going into next year. Yeah. Love having, a U.S. Asset class investor in London to pair up our global teams there. And so I think I feel pretty good about their ability to find the great opportunities that we'll see for 2026, both in Europe and in the U.S.
Yeah, awesome. All right, so we're going to move things along here. We're going to talk about an asset class that is very much related to high yield, and that is CLOs, and we will bring on our next guest. So we are joined in person here by Adrian Butler, head of global CLOs here at Barings. Adrian, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's great to see you again.
Yes, thank you for being here. I'd love to have you here in person to speak with Trevor and I, and CLOs are obviously an asset class that Barings has been involved with for a long, long time. An asset class that's, you and I actually had a chance to sit down earlier this year. We had a kind of a look back through time conversation, and we traced the last 25 years or so of the development of the CLO market, which was very interesting for me personally, just to hear a lot of the historical context. But what I was hoping you could touch on maybe to start is there's a lot of innovation happening in this market right now. It's to me, as someone who's not in it every single day, it seems from the outside, it's like, whoa, there's a lot of stuff happening there. And in terms of new asset classes, forming CLOs, et cetera. So maybe you can start there and just tell us what's going on there, why so much activity right now, and give us some perspective.
Sure, yeah, and you're right. Last time we spoke, you took me backwards and now you're taking me forward. So I have to try to keep up with where we're going here. We talked about this last time. If you think of CLOs as probably the most efficient way for equity to buy an asset or a diversified pool of assets, mm-hmm. then it makes sense that you take that same efficient structure and bring adjacent products to the table. And as CLOs have become just more mainstream investment vehicles for a variety of investment professionals, which mm-hmm. we'll talk about mm-hmm. later, I mm-hmm. think, you can see these other innovations develop. And I'll name a few that I think are important and probably are going to be growing into the future. First, and probably very topically, is European middle market CLOs. Mm-hmm. We opened that market at Barings in the fourth quarter of last year. Did the first one that's ever been created. Mm-hmm. Super excited to do that. Yep. We had another asset manager follow behind us and do something else earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And then we recently, in October, completed our second European middle market CLO, yes. $400 million reinvesting CLO with multi-currency features.
Right. So that was the first multi-currency Correct. One in the market.
Yeah. And so you've already seen an evolution from static to reinvesting multi-currency in the first three deals that have been out there. Mm. The key feature there is being able to have a big enough platform so that you can build a diversified pool of assets to put into the CLO. And that's one of the features that I think our sales and other managers are bringing to the table. And I think you'll see that grow. Mm-hmm. We like to be early. We like to move. We like to innovate. But we're well aware that there'll be people behind us who are mm-hmm. going to continue on that. Another trend would be, and Trevor, this leans into your commentary on sure. AI, infrastructure.
Yep.
Now, all the growth in infrastructure is not AI related, but clearly that is driving some of the demand for infrastructure. And I've seen, I think it was a McKinsey study that said it was like an investable universe of maybe $500 billion in 2016, and now it's $1.5 trillion. So that's more than double growth in less than 10 years. Mm. And then the projections going forward are even higher. Yep. Mm-hmm. When you've got a growing asset base like that, and you've got a lot of demand for that type of debt, it only stands to reason that an efficient mechanism to put it into makes a lot of sense. Mm. So I think looking at infrastructure CLOs is something that there are managers who've done mm-hmm. it, so don't mm-hmm. get me wrong, there mm-hmm. are managers who have done this, they've already established themselves. But I think taking a high quality asset class like that, low default, high recovery, diversified pool of assets, it gives an opportunity for investors now to invest into a diverse pool of infrastructure assets in bite sizes that make sense to them, mm-hmm. or from an equity perspective with a little bit of enhanced return.
Yeah.
So that's another. And then one last thing I'd mention in terms of innovation and creativity is the growth in the insurance sector. Mm-hmm. Bespoke transactions are really being done to meet the needs of duration, spreads, rating criteria of mm-hmm. insurance companies. Mm-hmm.
That is so interesting to me that almost what's happening in CLOs is very much a reflection of what we're seeing in other places. So you mentioned the AI and infrastructure. You mentioned middle markets, European middle market CLOs. That's obviously, we've seen a lot of growth in that market. We're seeing alternative lenders continue to gain share versus banks. So it totally makes sense to me that investors want another sort of access point, a way to kind of access these trends in an efficient way. Speaking of investors, just want to ask you, who's investing today in CLOs, and maybe how have you seen that change, or how is that changing currently?
Yeah, and that's a big question. So I'm going to break it up into two different sections. One being kind of the investor ecosystem, and the other one, maybe I'll take on a quick tour of the world. And
okay, we love tours,
opportunities.
Yeah. Okay.
So let me start with where we just finished, insurance companies. Mm-hmm. I think there was data out there that suggested insurance may have made up 24% of the investor base for CLOs in 2024. So they are a stable and reliable investor in the CLO market. Clearly, there's an NAIC desire to invest in the top of the stack for mm-hmm, CLOs. Mm-hmm. I think they are fundamental to the growth of our business, and we've seen the insurance bid continue to grow. So that's a stable and growing part of the sector. Banks, they've been around, they've been investing in CLOs for a long time, but that's growing, both on the money center side. We're seeing treasury units buy into top of the stack CLOs. And then we're seeing some of these large banks use that as a means to create CLO activity on mm-hmm. their CLO desks. So mm-hmm. we're seeing mm-hmm. the top of the stack demand in AAAs from banks. And then regional banks. Regional banks are really stepping into this market now. So they're creating an additional bid at the top of the stack. Pensions. I think pensions are seeing CLOs. Think MES, think belly of the stack, equity. They're seeing that as a diversifier to their alternatives bucket. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at making partnerships with asset managers that allow them not only access to regular CLO creation, but also access to vintage in the CLOs, making sure that they're getting vintage over a period of time. Mm-hmm. And that's been a growing sector. And then I'd be remiss if I only talked about institutional investors, because in today's world, retail,
sure.
Wealth.
Yeah.
It ties in a little bit to what Brian was talking about. Mm-hmm. That's a big sector. The ETF market, 2 years ago it was nothing. Now it's $38 billion.
Yeah, it's incredible.
We've really democratized the ability for the retail investor to invest in the CLO market. And that may not move the market, but it's a marginal dollar that is tightening the market. Mm. So we've seen that. Mm. So those are the four investors that I'd say are driving the market, growing the market, diversifiers to the market. My quick trip around the world, mm-hmm. if you've got a minute.
Yes.
Let's start in Charlotte. We've got a number of CLO managers right here, and we've got a number of CLO investors right here in Charlotte. Banks, asset managers, starting from my home location. If we go north of the border, Canada, big investor in CLO market. South of the border, we've had South American investors in our CLOs. Mm-hmm. Let's keep going. Let's go across the Pacific. Mm-hmm. We go to Japan. I can't go to Japan now for just a day or two. That's a 3 or 4 day event now. The number of investors in Japan, the sophistication we've seen and the number of investors we've seen there are immense. Not just the large players we know, but also the regional players.
Yeah.
And we're building relationships there. And I think every manager out there is doing that. Let's pop down the Pacific a little bit further. Mm-hmm. Australia. I mean, some of the most sophisticated CLO investors. They've been investing in CLO as long as I can remember. Mm-hmm. And they are still an active buyer, whether it's through CLOs or multi-strat accounts. I'm going to keep going on my plane. Middle East.
A lot of frequent flyer miles on this trip.
Oh, my gosh, right? They say the world is small, but it doesn't feel small to me now. Middle East, large investor base right there. They're building partnerships now with asset managers and really a strong bid in CLOs. And then if I bring it on home, on the European market, we've seen a number of investors there. But what we are seeing in Europe is a little bit of a bid there for European CLOs and paper. Some of it may be in a reaction to the volatility we've seen in the U.S., but I do think there's been a growth in the European market. So from a global perspective, CLO investors are really, the world's getting smaller.
Yeah.
That was an incredible, tour the globe. If we zoom out for a moment, in terms of macro influences for next year, it looks like we're entering a new interest rate regime. And, our base case is that the Fed does get down to neutral, so call it another 7,500 basis points of cuts. What's the impact on your asset class from getting lower interest rates? And is it different, and how do you think about it between, the top of the stack versus the bottom of the stack?
Yeah, it's a little nuanced depending on what part of the stack we're talking about. But let's level set real quickly for a minute. If we talk about CLOs, what we're talking about is a floating rate asset, a floating rate liability, and the arbitrage on the spread of the assets over the spread of the liabilities that makes the return to equity.
Sure.
So if I have two floating rate assets and the base rate changes,
All
I'm really worried about is the spread. So there is some minor impact when base rate changes, but just thinking about it from an equity buyer's perspective, what they're going to be most focused on is the spread on those liabilities. And we also know that in today's market, spreads are super tight.
Sure.
So if I'm an equity buyer right now of CLO equity, I'm saying I want to lock in super tight spreads.
Yep.
We're seeing AAA levels that have not been this tight since the GFC. So if I can lock in, and we've used this term before, a cheap credit card that I can go buy over the next 5 to 7 years, a diverse pool of assets, that makes a lot of sense to me. And we're seeing very sophisticated equity buyers lock in that tight cost of capital right now and take advantage of future volatility. Mm. Now, if I look at the debt, that gets a little bit different, right? Because I'm looking at an all-in yield right there. And right now, those yields are probably getting tight. If I look at a double B buyer right now, the difference between buying a double B tranche and a CLO versus a straight up double B loan is about 250 basis points in spread. Is that enough compensation to be in a double B CLO on a total return relative value basis? Maybe for some, maybe not for others. So I think from a debt investor standpoint, they're probably looking at that as more of a yield perspective, and there may be implications down the road as we see that tightening. But a secondary effect to all this is that the underlying assets that are in the CLO are probably going to benefit
right
from that lower base rate. And so if I see increased cash flow by default, maybe improved credit quality in the pool of assets I'm buying, that should be altogether a benefit to the CLO market.
For sure. What about in terms of, we've been talking to some of our colleagues on the private asset side. What you're seeing in terms of, the CLO managers continuing to have a strong bid for loans and how that's driving the mix between, from the borrower's perspective, looking at the broadly syndicated loan market versus private credit. What do you expect there for the next, several quarters?
Yeah, and the last couple of years, it's been all private credit, right? They've kind of been the winners. I think this is the first year we've seen equilibrium between private and public. My view is that that's probably about right. It probably should be an equilibrium between these two markets. I think creditors or borrowers, want to be able to want to have options. And firms like us where we can provide equal benefit on the public side and the private side, that's where we can really bring return both to our investors and to our clients.
Yep.
So I think that equilibrium is probably about right.
First of all, I want to thank you for taking us on this quick tour of CLOs and giving us a taste of your world for a minute. And I want to congratulate you and your team on an incredible year just with the European middle market CLO, infrastructure debt CLO, the most recent one that you just mentioned, the multi-currency one, it's been really fantastic to watch. And not to make this too much of a bearings commercial, but it's been really cool to see you and the team right in the mix of really driving a lot of the innovation in this space. But I'm not going to let you get away without giving us a prediction. So maybe we could just finish off with one bold prediction for 2026.
Yeah, I struggled with this one, but I'm going to call 2026 the year of the credit picker.
Mm-hmm.
I think this year was the year of the tight liabilities in CLO land.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm dealing with a closed-end fund like I am in CLOs, it's all going to be about credit picking.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the credit issues are idiosyncratic, whether it becomes something that's more programmatic, whether it's within an industry, I think this is credit picking time. When I look at the fundamentals in today's market, they're reminiscent of times we've seen, whether it's a tech bubble, whether it's 2007, and we manage CLOs through all of that. I don't know. Maybe these benign effects last for a long time and we're in a great market.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's going to be the credit picker who wins in 2026.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, we've seen, not that historical performance is indicative of what happens in the future, but we've seen the CLO structures be very strong through some of the periods that you've mentioned. So it'll be interesting to see whenever we hit this next cycle, whether it's 2026 or beyond, how the structures hold up. And based on everything that you and the team say, it seems like I have every confidence that these will continue to be a great place for investors to be. So, Adrian, it's been awesome having you here. Thank you. We could talk all day, but we're moving on. So thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was a great little tour de force around the world of CLOs. Anything jump out at you from that conversation?
Yeah, I love the around the world in 80 seconds there from Adrian. Yeah. And again, I love this idea of 2026 being the year of the stock picker, credit picker, I should say. I think that's going to be a common theme.
Yeah. All right. Well, without further ado, let's bring on our next guest. Very excited to be joined in person here by Charles Sanford.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
Yes, Charles, you are head of global investment grade credit here at Barings. And we're going to talk IG credit. So let's get into it. I'm going to pass it along to Trevor. Maybe we'll start kind of higher level with this one.
Yeah, let's do it. So, you know, when people think about high quality fixed income, you've got the treasury market, typically your risk-free market, then you've got investment grade corporate bonds. Historically, you think about, again, treasuries being the risk-free component, but now as we look forward, and certainly the last couple of years, $2 trillion in net annual issuance from the deficit spending, obviously questions around Fed independence, and there's starting to be some sort of cracks in the narrative around the quality of the federal treasury market. How do you think about owning into 2026 and beyond, you know, exposure to, say, Microsoft's balance sheet versus the federal government?
Yeah, no, and a lot of people are talking about this. Do you want to own 10-year Microsoft or you want to own 10-year Treasury? Yeah. And what should the spreads be? And so if you know, obviously the Treasury is risk-free in the sense that it is free of default risk, and I will grant you that. They can tax, they can print money, and so that's a good power to have. I wish I had that.
Sure.
That being said, if you start to look at the government on some of the fundamental characteristics that you look at corporate credit, you look at balance sheet, you look at cash flow, you look at the ability of the management team to sort of muddle its way through crises, pretty quickly you get to the fact that Microsoft actually looks fairly good. You know, you brought up sort of the balance sheet and debt to GDP has been growing quite a bit over at the U.S. government. And, you know, if back in the crisis, you know, we both were here during the financial crisis. And if you told me then where debt to GDP was now, you would clearly think we are either in or will be soon in a crisis.
For
and
sure.
Whereas if you look at, you know, generically the investment grade corporate balance sheets, you know, they're actually in very good shape. And over the past couple of years, they've been focused very heavily on improving their leverage. And so if you look at sort of the range of where they've been over the last decade, it's sort of right in the middle. So I sort of like that. And importantly, if you look at the highest credit quality companies, they literally have negative net debt.
Yeah.
And so they're, you know, they have more cash and marketable securities than they do debt. Not that they're going to do this and not that they should, but literally if they wanted to, they could pay off all of their debt today and still have a lot of cash left over. So, and then if you look at cash flow, you know, the U.S. government has large, persistent, and growing deficits, whereas if you look at the cash flow capabilities of most investment-grade companies, and specifically, you know, Microsoft or any of these, like, AAA or AA companies, it's really just astounding how powerful they are. They are juggernauts in terms of, you know, either EBITDA or free cash flow, whatever you want to look at, in terms of that capability. And then the last thing that I would really say is if you look at the ability of the management teams to sort of weave their way through crises, and, you know, we're sort of early on in the tariffs, but if you look at COVID, if you look at sort of the energy crisis for the energy companies, investment grade management teams are very, very strong. And they've been able to navigate this and literally during these crises improve their fundamentals. And, you know, I don't think you'd find many people who say that's true on the U.S. government side. And so, you know, 10-year Microsoft is probably trading at 20 basis points, you know, in that zip code. You don't have that far to go before it turns negative. Sure. And so I think especially if you have a crisis that is focused on the U.S. government in the next year or 2 years, you could easily start to see a cohort of Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA trading literally through U.S. government bonds.
Pretty
remarkable. And I would probably be in favor of that myself.
Sure.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that is pretty incredible. Some of these companies are sort of the size of small countries, I guess.
And global and embedded into multiple economies. And so,
Let me ask you almost like the flip side of that coin in terms of risk. So there's a lot of skepticism out there around just the billions and billions of dollars of CapEx that are being spent by some of these large tech companies. We were chatting with Brian earlier just about the AI trend and with Adrian as well. I'm curious, kind of, as you look across the investable universe of investment grade credit, where are you seeing kind of tangible impacts, either directly or indirectly, from this proliferation of AI?
Yeah, much as the AI story has been evolving rapidly over time, the impact in the investment grade market has been evolving rapidly over time. And so, you know, if you had asked me this a few months ago, and I think Trevor actually did ask me this a few months ago, there really was no impact. Mm. And so the AI companies were funding their CapEx really out of free cash flow, out of equity investments in the private markets, but there really was no direct impact, no issuance in the public investment grade corporate market. That recently has changed. You know, there was a very convoluted Meta deal that just hit the market, very large. You know, they set up an SPV with Blue Owl. It was very convoluted. I'd be shocked if you see a lot of those very complex deals come into the investment grade market. You probably see some more.
Are more of those happening in the private market?
They're definitely happening in the private market. Yeah. And interestingly, this last one was actually marketed in the private market, and I was trading in the public market. And so you're seeing some of these, like, it's not quite hybrid, but almost
that's
like hybrid
deals. It's the blurring
deals.
Of lines right
it's
there.
It's the blurring of lines. And you're going to start to see much more of that, I think, over the coming years. There'll be another large sort of Oracle-related deal, but which will likely happen in the loan market, and so it won't impact the public investment grade market as much. But what I think you're really going to start seeing is it bleed into the investment grade market proper in 26 and 27, because you know, there's so much around the data centers in terms of energy needs and literally moving dirt just to build these things and the infrastructure around it. And so I think you're gonna start to see a lot more issuance from the regulated utilities. You know, obviously they're issuing a lot more debt now just generically with onshoring of manufacturing and then the electrification of the US. But this will be a whole nother set of need for these utilities. And so they're going to be issuing debt. And then, like I said, literally just to like move the dirt, you know, the capital goods companies like Caterpillar are gonna need to scale up to do all of this. Yeah. And so you're gonna start to see all this CapEx money, not just focused specifically on chips, but really bleed out into the rest of the economy to sort of support all the data centers and the infrastructure around the data centers that need to be put in place.
Now, Brian mentioned earlier that in the high yield market, there have been some issues that have been threatened by AI kind of rolling out broadly. Let me just ask you, you know, I don't know if there's as much of that in the IG market, call centers and such, but are you seeing issuers that are threatened by AI?
It's a great question. Sort of similar to Brian's answer, it's a very complex answer, one that I'm not sure I have, you know, a whole lot of insight into. But I will say that there are sort of primary effects and secondary effects. And on the primary effects, I think this is like wholeheartedly positive for investment grade companies. You know, this isn't great for a lot of individuals, but you're starting to see headlines around companies being able to do more with less, and Amazon sort of laying off a number of people. You know, there are going to be a lot of efficiencies that I think, you know, talking back to the management theme, a lot of these management teams are going to be able to harness AI and really improve their cost structure. And that's only going to improve the fundamentals of investment grade companies. And so I don't think you have as many companies threatened as you might in the high yield market. So I think this is actually going to be a real boon for the investment grade markets and the fundamentals of the investment grade market. That being said, the secondary effect is going to be the impact on the labor market. And so that could impact sales. And you know, but again, I would trust the management team of investment grade companies to sort of manage around this and massage their pricing strategy, their supply lines, the cost structure of the companies to adjust to the new situation that we're likely going to find ourselves in over the next couple of years.
Just to maybe look ahead to 2026, you talked about have some tight valuations in certain parts of the market, certainly the most traditional parts of the market. What about the less trafficked areas of investment grade? What are you seeing in terms of opportunities around preferreds, AT1s? again, these sort of less trafficked areas of your market?
Yeah, I'm going to caveat everything saying we are literally a generational tights and all relationships are very compressed. And so, you know, start with that as the basis. And so we were literally having a discussion whether or not you could literally be in the zeroth percentile. Mm-hmm. Philosophically, you can do that. that being said, there are still pockets of the investment grade market that do make sense. And you mentioned preferreds. You know, we have been very active participants in preferreds recently. That being said, you know, investment grade preferreds as far as started to trade through 6%. We typically don't like to get down into mm-hmm. that zip code. But if you look at double B rated securities of investment grade companies, you can still get 6.25%, 6.5%. And so we still think that's actually a reasonable level to invest in. And so we're sort of focused on that part of the preferreds market. There are definitely, and again, this goes back to the theme at Barings of having sort of a large and very experienced analyst staff.
Sure.
We definitely are very comfortable looking at the niches of the investment grade market. And so there are definitely some niches still, mainly in the financial space. You can find some very small insurance companies that really are not very covered by other teams. And so we have gotten to know a lot of these companies yep. recently. And so we still find some spread opportunities and sort of that in the financials space writ large. BDCs are another area mm-hmm. That are sort of not necessarily new, but newer to the investment grade market. And those are still trading at very wide levels. You know, the nuance there is you have to be very careful about what they are invested in. Sure. And so there's a lot of nervousness around sort of the private credit market. And this is our window into the private credit market. Some companies are more focused on the top of the capital stack versus the bottom. And so we think a sweet spot right now for the BDCs are the companies that are invested in the higher quality, sort of those first lien securities. Mm-hmm. And so we really focus on that, but we find a lot of opportunity there.
Fantastic. I wanted to ask you about sectors. I think you just answered that question more or less, but mm-hmm. let me just ask you kind of, as we kind of think about 2026, everything that you've said so far, you know, especially given where spreads are, how would you characterize the attractiveness of your asset class heading into 2026? How are you feeling about the opportunity ahead of you for the next 12 months?
I feel really good about it. And so again, with the caveat that spreads are incredibly tight right now, you know, since I think 1998, I think is where we sort of like got to before from these spread levels. That being said, and it depends if you have more of a absolute return orientation or a relative return orientation, but if you're, you know, more of like the insurance investor and you're looking for more of a yield orientation, we find very good credit quality companies at attractive yields. I think that came up earlier mm-hmm. in your discussions here, but we're finding lots of opportunities there. And so from an insurance perspective, we can put money to work in companies that I'm very confident in and can hit your rate of return, absolutely no problem. We have been urging companies or our clients to move up in quality when we're doing this. And so we're trying to take a little bit less risk than we normally would, but we feel very good about the money that we're putting to work in sort of the insurance side of the business or the pension side of the business. In more of the relative return side of the business where we're trying to outperform an index, it's a little bit more nuanced. And so, as we said, we're finding sort of from a credit picking perspective, mm-hmm. we find plenty of opportunities, but then you also have to take into account the fact that spreads are as tight. And so the things you can do around portfolio structure where you do put most of your risk in the very short end of the curve. And so all of your short, you know, your risk is really in the short duration part, the 0 to 3 part of the curve,
yep.
and you underweight risk in the long end of the curve. And so with this portfolio strategy, you can out-yield or out-spread the index right now. And so even if spreads don't move and we've had very little volatility, and we probably won't for some period of time, and so you can outperform from that perspective. But then when spreads widen out, you actually outperform in the long end of the curve because you're underweight risk,
yep.
but you're still, and you're not really going to underperform as much in the front end of the curve, because even if you underperform a little bit, the pull to par is so powerful that you can, you know, spreads will come right back mm-hmm. in essentially mm-hmm. over the mm-hmm. next 12 months.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So that is our portfolio strategy. It's worked very well in past crises. And, you know, even if we do have a little volatility in 2026, we think we'll perform fine yep. with that strategy.
Well, I will say, I think the investment grade market gets a bad rap in terms of not always being the source of excitement, but we're asking
I think
for,
it's incredible. I will take the other side
you
of
make
all
it
day
exciting,
long.
Charles. Let's put it that way.
With that backdrop, would love to hear a bold prediction for 2026.
So I was wondering how thematic people were going to be here. And so I'm going to take Brian's sort of theme and sort of expand on it a little bit.
Sure.
So going back to our original part of the discussion, I am going to say that my anticipation is that there have been so many sort of pent up issues in the market writ large in the mm-hmm. macro economy as well as in the investment grade market that in 2026 we are really going to start to see a little bit more volatility, sure. but probably not for a little bit. And so I am going to say two parts. that we are going to have some cohort trade through treasuries. And so I do think you're going to start to see the Microsofts, Apples, Nvidias of the world potentially you know, trade through treasuries and have negative spreads. It has happened in the past with Microsoft. You know, it happened in France not too long ago. And so I think you're going to see that. But in addition, I think you're going to start to see real volatility and potentially see spreads get out to crisis levels sometime in 2026. And so I think you're going to really have bookends all during 2026. And so you say investment grade is not exciting. I think it's going to be incredibly exciting in 2026 and beyond.
I love it. One bold prediction, but two.
Two.
Yeah,
exactly. Fantastic. This is in case you don't have me on again. So I want to make sure I'm just going to right now.
Charles, this has been great. You make investment grade credit exciting. We appreciate it. So thanks for being here.
No, well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
Bye. Thanks, Charles.
I actually thought that was really fascinating just to hear about, especially like the potential for spreads on some of these large tech companies to trade inside U.S. government treasuries. I don't know, any big takeaways for you from that one?
I thought similar parallels to what Brian Pacheco was saying about the high yield market in terms of a little bit of sequencing in terms of a lot of near-term tailwinds may push markets to new tights, but then some of these economic divergences that we've been talking about could potentially gain enough momentum to create some cracks that beget more volatility in the back half of next year. So it seems like it's going to be a year where active management is key.
It's going to be an interesting year shaping up that way. All right, well, let's turn to our final guest who has been patiently waiting. I want to bring on Chem Karashadan, our head of sovereign debt and currencies, joining us live from Boston. Chem, thanks for your patience. Good to have you here.
Not at all. Good to be here. Thank you.
All right, good stuff. Well, let's get going. I'm going to turn over to Trevor because I think let's start with the macro on this one again.
Chem, how are you thinking about the value in EM today on an absolute basis? What are you seeing in terms of flows? And just sort of assessing the value, whether it's in the rates market, the currency markets, and then can touch on credit as well if you'd like.
So let's start with credit, which is the unidimensional, and it has the common feature with Charles in investment grade and Brian in high yield. When we think about spreads, sovereign debt spreads, emerging market sovereign debt spreads, they too are tight. Fundamentally, the way we look at spreads are they are compensation for expected losses. And by that standard, they still comfortably overcompensate for default risk for the bulk of the issuers. We also know that spreads are expected to compensate for market risk. And Brian eloquently spoke to that point. And we totally agree. A year ago, we wrote a piece titled Spreads Are Too Tight. So what, where we claimed that spreads were tight, but we were comfortable with them, and we still think the same, partly because volatility, in fact, is low. So there is value in credit and even greater value in local currency debt. And there's two dimensions to local currency debt. One is local rates, and their nominal yields and therefore real yields in emerging markets are, we think, way too high or higher than they need to be, and that they will come down, and that creates opportunity to enjoy yield compression. You have markets like Mexico, nominal yields 8%, real yields 4%, Brazil, Colombia, South Africa, where yields are double digit, Colombia, real yields north of 5%, 6%, 7%, all of which are examples of them being too high. And we love the opportunity that presents. Never mind on the margin, frontier local currency markets that have also high double digit returns with stable exchange rates. And then the other leg of the local currency debt opportunity is exchange rates. And there, when we do our balance payments analysis, bottom up sources and uses of foreign exchange, we're very comfortable with owning currencies. And there is the potential on the margin as investors seek to diversify away from U.S. markets, away from the dollar, that emerging market currencies will benefit from more flows than in the past.
Sure.
Hey, Chem, you mentioned the piece you wrote, I think it was in 2024, the piece about spreads and really making the case. Yep. I think you said it's called Spreads Are Tight, So What? And you and the team really made a strong, compelling case that that potential returns, potential attractive returns were still very much on the table in the asset class. So just to be clear, are you kind of still advocating for that stance today when it comes to kind of EM broadly? And then I guess I would ask you, when you compare the fundamental picture of everything you're seeing today relative to that spread level, kind of where do you come out in the end?
So the short answer is absolutely yes. We reiterate the view that we expressed about 15 months ago that spreads look tight and historically are tight, but they are still attractive because they do way overcompensate for default risk. And if you want some compensation for market risk, one measure of market risk is the volatility of returns, whether that's for US Treasuries or for the emerging market sovereign debt asset class. The volatility of those returns normalized for the yields from which you start, that ratio is actually the lowest it's been in years and lower today than it was even last year. And one of the main reasons why it's low is because of the denominator. The starting yields, U.S. Treasury yields are higher today than they were several years ago, a point that Trevor opened the podcast with and others have also talked about, the all-in yield we keep referring to. Of course, that includes U.S. Treasury yields. But that is material and significant because it affects the way you should think about market volatility or the compensation you get for volatility, which to me should be very little. So 100% stand by the thoughts that we expressed in that piece.
Fantastic. Should we do a lightning round?
Let's do it. Jim, maybe just to finish up here, two places that you are seeing value today or heading into the new year, I should say, maybe two places where you're seeing particular value.
Mexico is one. We love Mexico across the board, both in hard currency debt, where you can buy 30-year dollar-denominated paper at 90 basis points in spread. This is an investment grade rated sovereign where you pick up more than double the spreads you'll find in developed markets or even many of the more highly rated emerging markets like Chile, Indonesia, Philippines. Also in local currency debt, I just mentioned earlier, it came into the year with 10% yields. Now it's at 8%. We still find those yields attractive. If I were to offer a second category, that'd be other developed emerging market, investment grade, emerging market local currency yields. So I would throw, in addition to Mexico, Peru, Chile, Czech Republic as local yields that we like. And lastly, we like frontier yields. I mentioned it earlier, and among those are Nigeria, Egypt. One of our latest ads, which I'm quite proud of, is 10-year paper, believe it or not, in the country of Uganda that enjoys as low as inflation as almost we have in the U.S., but the nominal yield of which is 17%. Hmm. So there's a wide spectrum of opportunity. I should also say emerging markets, right, is a very wide space. There's a lot of a wide range from triple C all the way to double A. So you have to pick your spots. While we make general claims that spreads can be or will be tighter within that range, our goal is to own the right things and obviously avoid the wrong ones.
Yeah, got it. Okay, I love it. That's one of the things I love about your team, Jim, is just the breadth of the universe that you all cover and the expertise to go from Mexico to Uganda and to be able to take those trips around the world and obviously all the languages that everybody speaks and all that kind of stuff. It's great to see that kind of analysis taking place. I mean, it's been really interesting to me and really notable to me just in the last several months that a sort of shift that I have perceived in terms of investor psychology just around EM. We've seen it, I think, in our own business in terms of new mandates and that kind of stuff that are coming in, which has been really interesting to see. So I think a lot of your messages seem to be resonating. But I'm going to ask you for one final message, and that is a bold prediction for 2026. So we're going to put you under pressure here, Jim, and we want to get one prediction here for you. What do you got for us?
Well, if you'll allow me, I'll make two, one of which is not coordinated with the other speakers, but it does have to do with spreads.
Okay.
Our listeners should know that you did alert us that you'd asked the prediction question, but none of us coordinated our answers.
Right.
And despite that,
we didn't want to know. We don't want to know in advance.
Right. But one of the ones that I did have high conviction on was in precisely the point about spreads, which Brian himself mentioned. And I do think more likely than not, emerging market debt spreads, both corporate and sovereign, here I'm emphasizing sovereign, will be, you know, more likely than not lower this time next year. And one tangential related point I would make is with respect to the U.S. and AI, if and when we get a burst in the stock market, bubble that some people call it, or a U.S. slowdown, Trevor opened up with the weak labor market in the U.S., those two eventualities would actually be quite positive for EM. So that's just a scenario under the scenario where the U.S. faces difficulties, whether financial or economic or both. Those would be very positive for EM. So I think there's more upside than downside in EM in 2026.
All right. Good stuff. Jim, you've given us a lot to think about, as always. And thank you again for your patience being the anchorman for this discussion. I think it was worth the wait. And we really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
All right, there we have it. We took a quick trip around the world. We hit high yield, we hit CLOs, we hit investment grade, and then we just hit emerging markets. Not to put you on the spot right away, but what stuck out to you? Maybe give me one or two reactions.
Yeah, I thought, we had Adrian talk about the year of the credit picker in 2026. Mm-hmm. From the IG and high yield teams, we heard about some sequencing in terms of maybe reaching new tights first before getting to some renewed volatility. And then obviously the relative value, opportunities in EM as well. So strikes me as going to be a great year for active management. And I think also a great year we're having access to, a breadth of expertise across an investment platform is going to prove incredibly valuable.
Yeah, totally agree. There's a lot that stood out to me. I think that the one thing that I will kind of conclude with is that I think that we think that this is very much the start of the conversation, not the end of the conversation. There's a lot of different ways that we'd love for you all to interact with us throughout 2026 and beyond. A couple of those things I want to just flag to you. One, we're going to do this again next week. So we're going to be doing our private credit outlook next week. Trevor and I are going to get the band back together. So if you're interested in that, we're going to be talking about direct lending, asset-based finance, and portfolio finance. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. Secondly, just wanted to flag to you, you can follow us on LinkedIn. We're very active there. We post all of our latest thoughts, all of our latest podcasts and videos and thought pieces, et cetera. We actually just launched a new newsletter called Where Credit is Due. It's right on LinkedIn. It's a monthly newsletter that covers public and private credit markets. And you can subscribe to our podcast, Streaming Income, where I get to interview Brian, Charles, Adrian, Chem, everybody you saw today. I have an embarrassment of riches of guests. And so we get into all these asset classes in much more detail. And then lastly, I want to give a plug to Trevor, who's doing some great stuff on LinkedIn these days. So go follow Trevor on LinkedIn, and he'll tell you about his monthly markets call that he's doing as well, that's gaining quite the cult following as well. So very much worth your time. So like I said, this is the beginning of the conversation, not the end of the conversation. So we'd love for you to engage with us. On behalf of Trevor, myself, all of our speakers here today, and the entire team at Barings, just want to thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate your time. We appreciate your trust and your partnership. Thanks so much.